and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and I am joined here today with Bruegel's own Bertin Martens and Fiona Scott-Morton in this special extra episode to talk about the EU's first fines issued under the Digital Markets Act. You may have seen that Apple and Meta were subject to fines under a decision 23rd of April, and that Apple was hit with a 500 million euro fine and Meta with a 200 million fine. Fiona, can you help our listeners understand what they did to trigger these fines and what this means?
Yeah, the DMA is a law that requires designated gatekeepers to comply with a list of about 22 rules. And they are required to turn in a compliance report each year explaining how they are complying with these rules. And when those reports were turned in March of 2024, almost immediately, the commission opened several non-compliance investigations. And one was against Apple and one was against Meta. The non-compliance investigation on Apple's steering terms, so that's can developers steer you, inform customers that they don't have to buy the app inside the App Store and pay 30%, where the developer has to pay 30% to Apple, but rather the developer could encourage users to go outside Apple's App Store and allow them to make a purchase there. That capability was blocked by Apple. And then Meta, the non-compliance decision against Meta, was about Meta's consent or pay model, which is the practice that Meta has of saying, if you don't want our personalized targeted advertising, you can either pay money to have the regular Meta service, or you can watch some non-skippable full screen ads that to have a slightly less personalized experience, or you can be defaulted into the normal Meta product, but all three of them still permit Meta to track your personal data around the web. So those were the two non-compliance investigations that were opened. They had a year to finish them. The year was aspirational. The year ended right about the time of Tariff Day, and so the decisions were a little bit delayed till just a couple days ago, and both of the firms were fined.
How big are these fines?
They're very small in relation to the profits that were earned by the non-compliant behavior. I think the reason to start with small fines is to emphasize that what the commission is looking for is compliance. This law is not a money-making scheme. It's an induced compliance scheme. But I would further note that a non-compliance decision by itself is quite important for these corporations, because the law says that if you accumulate three non-compliance decisions within 8 years, that the commission is then allowed to take more serious actions, such as requiring divestitures, prohibiting mergers, and the maximum fine rises to 20% of global turnover. And that is really a very large number for both of these companies.
Ben, where does this law fit into the EU's constellation of big digital regulations?
There are several of these big tech regulation or big digital regulations. There is, apart from the DMA, the DSA, the Digital Services Act. However, the two are separate pieces, I would say. The Digital Services Act focuses on social media platforms, essentially, and compliance with a number of European values, with non-discrimination, with legal content, and a number of other issues around the social media. So I would not mix the two up. They are two different pieces of legislation. There are a number of other pieces of digital regulation in the EU, such as, for example, the Data Act, and GDPR on privacy protection of personal data. Again, these are separate pieces of regulation. They affect all these big tech companies. And there may be some degree of overlap, especially the Data Act, data sharing provisions under the Data Act and the GDPR with the DMA. But we should essentially look at them as separate pieces of legislation.
The Facebook decision in particular seems to have a lot to do with how Facebook handles people's data and what they can and can't do with it. Can you talk us through what that means and what's possible versus what the EU wants versus what Meta is willing to do?
Yeah, so under the DMA, there is an obligation for gatekeepers not combine data from different services, personal data from different services, unless the user has consented to that. And this was the case for Meta, that has several social media platforms, Facebook, but also Instagram and WhatsApp and a number of other services. And so what Meta had proposed to do was to ask indeed users for consent, but the consent was restricted to two options. Either consent that we combine your data across different services or pay a subscription, a fee, and then you will get the service without the combination of data. The Commission has decided that this is not sufficient to comply with Article 5.2 in the DMA, that it should offer users more options. Meta actually started doing that since the end of last year, and the Commission is still investigating that new intermediate option that Meta has proposed, and the Commission has not taken a decision in that yet, though it reserves itself the right to also find that intermediate case in non-compliance and possibly levy another fine on that new system. We don't know yet what's going to happen there. I would like to point out, though, that in Germany, there was a similar Facebook case, and the German court has agreed that what Facebook is doing, when it charges an appropriate fee for an equivalent service, that would be accepted. Now then, the question is, what is appropriate and to what extent does this new Meta proposal fit with that definition? And so that's up to the Commission to decide whether or not that's compliant.
Let me pile on there for a minute and say I actually think that the Meta behavior is worse than what Burton just described, because while the user can pay to not see ads under the Formosa 2024, and that's what this non-compliance fine is about, Meta does not actually promise that it is not taking your personal data from around the web. And in none of the three options is there any change, at least according to the statements of Meta, about the harvesting of personal data. It's just a change in what sort of ads you see. And if you pay money, you don't see any ads, then there's two different kinds of ads. So I think actually it's a pretty deep problem here, because it's not that the law, the GDPR and the DMA are not about what kind of ads somebody wants to show when. They're about the personal data being processed. And of course, one reason you might process it is to show an ad, but there are lots of other reasons to process it too. And they all, many of them, require the permission of the user.
It's so interesting that all of this is happening now, because we have the beginnings of what could be a trade war between the US and the EU over the tariffs that the Trump administration is talking about putting in place, and in some cases has put in place all over the world. And we also have US regulators seeing their attempts to oversee these big tech companies coming to a head. As I understand it, there is a big lawsuit trial going on right now in the US where Meta is under fire for possibly buying Instagram and WhatsApp for anti-competitive reasons, as opposed to pure business practices, whatever those are. Fiona, are we right to try and look holistically at all of this and think that maybe there's some pressure for things to change at these big companies?
Well, I think we've known for some years that our digital markets were not very competitive. And that's why, well, I mean, the EU was first, the Commission was first in 2010 with the Google search case. But we did see between 2020 and 2023, the United States across two different administrations file monopolization cases against Google Search, Google Ad Tech, Meta, Amazon, and Apple. So we have many of these cases in the pipeline. The Google Search is finished and the government won. Google Ad Tech is finished and the government won. Now, of course, Google will appeal those, so it's quite possible that a higher court will overrule the court that actually conducted the trial. But in the meantime, we have to think about remedies. And interestingly, at the same time that we are conducting the Meta trial, the FTC is conducting the Meta trial, there's a judge, the judge in the Google Search case, is holding a hearing about what remedies might be in Google Search. And many journalists are writing about what the remedies might be in Google Ad Tech since we just got the decision in Ad Tech. So there's really a lot of action thinking about what the solutions could be. And that dovetails rather nicely with the DMA because many of the rules in the DMA are effectively the sorts of remedies that regulators would like to see in these markets. And the European approach to getting those remedies is pass a regulation. And the US approach, we'll see if it works, is bring a lawsuit, hope it's not overturned, hope the remedy is not overturned, hope the judge can actually effectuate the remedy over time and successfully ride herd on the corporation that does not want to comply with the remedy. All of that's pretty difficult. So I'm not too optimistic that in the US we're going to have anything that really works. But what might be good is a combination of the EU and the US. So one of the things that is helpful to judges in the United States is watching firms comply in Europe and seeing that something actually is technically feasible, has been built, seems to not be hurting anybody. And if you can point at that, you could say, well, why don't we do that here? Because I know that it's no incremental cost for the corporation. They've already built it. And I know what it's going to do. I can see the outcome in Europe. And the same could be said the other way around. If there's some remedy in the United States that's useful, the people enforcing the DMA may say, well, effective compliance really requires that you're doing the best you can. And I can tell from the remedies you've deployed elsewhere that there could be improvements here.
In the next part of our podcast, I'd like to continue to try to untangle these various things. Fiona just talked about appeals on the U.S. side for some of these U.S. court cases. Burton, should we expect to see appeals of these fines? Should we be watching those for the precedent they set as much as for the money at stake itself?
Yes. Apple and Meta have already announced that they will appeal to those fines. So, but they still have to implement what the commission asked them to do in the meantime. But yes, so we can expect an appeals process. How long that's going to spin out, we'll have to see. Fiona just said it's probably going to be much shorter than what we've seen in the past with classic competition cases. I hope this will be true. But in any case, I think the DMA process is a process. And so the commission is taking several steps, step by step, and this is going to spread out over a number of years before we see, I think, big impact on these gatekeeper companies under the DMA. What's happening on the other side of the Atlantic, I think, is much bigger guns are being put into place against these big tech companies. Breaking up Meta is something of an altogether different order of magnitude as telling Meta that it has to handle its personal data combination in a different way. Breaking up Google's search monopoly or intervening, structurally intervening in its apps monopoly is a really very fundamental approach. And if that goes through in different courts that will still have to look at these cases in the US, if that is finally accepted, that would change completely the structure of the internet as we know it today. what the outcome is going to be, very hard to predict, but it will definitely change things very fundamentally.
Tell us more about that. What do you mean fundamentally change the internet? What would change?
Take, for example, Google or Alphabet. Basically, advertising is by far its largest source of revenue, although the last couple of years, cloud services are also coming up as an important source, but still, advertising is the main source of revenue. And if these competition cases, these antitrust cases would break up that monopoly in advertising, this is going to make a very big dent in Alphabet and Google's revenue. Who is going to take over this fragments of that advertising empire? Similarly, in the Google search case, if Google would have to divest its Chrome web browser, that would make a very, very big change in the way Google organizes its whole business empire. Who's going to buy the Chrome browser? Who will take that over?
Will the government allow Meta to buy the Chrome browser or Amazon? Probably not. Probably it would be some advertising business. And we don't have privacy laws in the United States, so that means that you can have a business of harvesting people's data and selling it, which is what Chrome is optimized to do. I think I agree with Burton that it's a big threat to Google's revenue, and I'm not sure that the Chrome divestiture, therefore, will be something that courts will allow, because what it really is Google's way of harvesting personal data. And if they can't do that, they can't run the ads business. And that's slightly different than search. And the case was about search. So I'm not sure that that nexus will be tight enough. In addition to which, they need the browser, so they'll just build another one. So if you were going to make them sell it, you'd have to. And if they build another one and package it in with Android and the package that OEMs have to put on the front page, then I don't know what value Chrome really has at that point. So it would have to come with a line of business restriction, and that, again, is something a court would have to approve. So it's a little difficult to know where that advertising side would go. I would actually like to say something about the human side of it. So you go to search, and you're ideally, in an ideal world, you would have not a monopolist offering you a search result, but actually a few different choices. And those search results might be organized differently by an entrant. They might have fewer ads. They might come from a trusted sources. They might be curated in some way that appeals to a niche or a certain segment of users. And rather like the way we shop for cars, and there are many different sizes and shapes and colors and fuel choices, it would be really nice to have a search engine that had a little bit of variety. And that might be possible because an entrant, in contrast to being shut out as they are today, would be able to become a default on an Android handset or an Apple handset. So that's kind of the exciting element there. And then, of course, that affects all the information we get from the internet. Most people interact with the internet through a Google search property, and that affects not just your commercial choices, but all the information you see in your life as a citizen.
Two further comments on this. One is that the implosion of Alphabet or Google's advertising empire will not only affect advertising revenue for Google and Alphabet, but also for many publishers on the internet. There are many websites that live from publishing ads and the revenue that that generates. We always, as economists, assume that breaking up this monopolistic empire will reduce the price of ads, will be more competition. But will publishers benefit from that is still an open question to me. So.
Oh, I think they will. I think the problem with the two-sided platform is the take rate in the middle gets big, and both the advertisers pay more and the publishers get less. And if you squeeze the margin of the middleman, then I think both sides get some of the benefit of the reduction in market power. So the publisher gets to keep a bit more, the advertiser pays a bit less, and the party in the middle gets a lot less.
But to me, the question is, what will happen to advertising effectiveness, targeted advertising effectiveness, if you break up the empire? Will the Will the fragments, the combination of all the fragments, still be as effective as the combined whole is? And how does that affect the pricing of advertising? And I think that is an open question. Second comment was on surge. In the US, indeed, so there's a lot of pressure on Google search monopoly, which is now officially recognized as a monopoly. And I think that was clear to everybody for many, many years. If you hold more than 90% of the market, you basically have a monopoly. But in search, and I've advocated this in a Bruegel publication a year ago, longer ago, it's important to combine all the data from search in a big pool. And now what both on the US side and what the EU DMA asks the search engine gatekeepers to do is to share those data with other search engines. If that sharing happens on a bilateral basis, I think that will be wonderful. We keep the pool of search data so that everybody who runs a search engine can take data from that pool to make it search engine effective. In the DLA, we have a one-sided approach where the gatekeeper would have to share its search engine data with other search engines, but not vice versa, which implies that the pool of search engine data will become fragmented. And so the question is, how will that affect the efficiency of search? Will we all lose from breaking up Google's search monopoly? We don't have clear answers to that at the moment, I think. But it's a risk that I think is real and that we should look into.
Yeah. One of the remedies that's in play on the US side is sharing the web index that Google builds every day when it crawls the internet. If a web index were available at a zero royalty for entrants, that would enable the entrant to only need to have an algorithm and not have to spend the enormous amount of money to crawl the web frequently. And that's both very energy intensive, very expensive, and probably a natural monopoly. It's not clear to me what you get by having multiple people crawling the web. So that's one way to lower the fixed costs. And then we'll just have to see, as Burton said, if the algorithms can manage with only one quarter of the billions of searches rather than all of them.
Crawling the web to compile an index is one side of the search engine. The other side is the clicks that users do on the web links that you show to them. And there are also very important information. Now, what we see nowadays with strong growth in artificial intelligence is that several of these artificial intelligence companies are starting to build up their own web indexes because they need access to those web pages, not for search, but to collect the data to train their AI models. And the distinction between search and data and AI training data is becoming much more narrow, and they are virtually overlapping, especially over the last year now that we see AI services also offering search and reversely Google search offering building in AI results in its search results. So the convergence between those two models, I think, is already changing the market for web page indexes and for web data, and how that is going to evolve. Again, it's a very interesting place to watch nowadays on the internet, but still open to speculation.
It is so interesting how these cases really show the way the internet is a braid of really important things. You've got the companies that pay for the technology that sort of make it all possible. You have the actual technology of crawling the web and processing the data, like Burton was just saying. And you have the people who are using this stuff who need it to work and who don't have the power, most of them, to say, I'm going to choose a different product that doesn't work as well because I don't like the company. That level of disambiguation just isn't available to most people. For the last section of our podcast, I would like to talk about whether we should expect to see more companies hit with DMA fines coming up soon. And what happens next? I'd like to come back. We touched on the tariffs. Do you think that these could be a political football in the trade talks with the US, Burton?
Yes, there are certainly more DMA cases going to come up. The Commission is already preparing something on Alphabet, and we expect that any day now. The Commission has announced it's further investigating Meta, so there are also more things there to be expected. On tariffs, whether they are going to play a role, we see that tariffs start to play a role for companies like Apple, clearly, because they sell hardware, phones, and laptops, and there's hardware in that and chips going into that. And so there are tariffs. US is charging tariffs on that, and that's a big blow to the Apple business model. Fortunately, they got a reprieve for a couple of days, but we'll see how that works out in the longer term. For the EU, I'm not so sure. Tariffs are certainly going to play a role for companies like Amazon because they sell goods, and transatlantic tariffs, possibly in both directions, would seriously upset that business model. So for trading, underlying trade in goods, e-commerce in goods, that would be important. Trade in digital services, there has been a lot of debate recently, especially on the EU side, whether the EU could impose tariffs on services, on digital services, as a sort of countervailing measures against US tariffs on goods. I have argued in a Bruegel publication that not only would that not be a wise thing to do, but also I don't see how it could possibly be done. We have digital services taxes in a number of EU countries. EU member states that levies on online revenue, basically. And they were imposed originally because it was felt that big US tech platforms were repatriating their revenue to the US or other tax havens in the world, and that the country where the revenue was generated could not tax that. And so digital services taxes were imposed as an equivalent for that. But what we see and what we find from the empirical evidence is that it's basically consumers and sellers on those platforms in the EU who pay those taxes. And so if the EU would like to use that as a retaliation against Trump's tariff measures, it would shoot itself in the foot. And so that's not something we would want to do. If you really want to impose a tariff on a digital services trade across the Atlantic, that would be very difficult to identify. Daron Acemoglu recently proposed this in a Financial Times article saying, well, why don't we simply impose a tax on advertising? We could do that, but who's going to pay finally that tax? It's going to be shifted again to either the advertiser or the publisher of the ad, most of which are located in the EU again. So targeting this on a pure transatlantic services trade is very hard to do. In digital services trade, I would like to point out, in digital services trade, the distinction between a cross-border transaction and a domestic transaction is just a distinction in the IP address of a website. And you can change that IP address in a millisecond. So I really don't see how you could do this in a meaningful way. The EU has this anti-coercion instrument that was designed to take measures in services when under coercion, when under grave pressure from another country or power. This instrument has been cited as a possible way to do this. But again, that instrument says any platform that has its substantive operations inside the EU could not be targeted under the anti-coercion instrument. Now, all big tech, US big tech platforms are legally resident in the EU, legally incorporated in the EU, and they do a lot of their business here. So how do we target those transactions that are not substantively based in the EU? I really don't see that.
Fiona, how do you look at this?
I wanted to come back a little bit to the fines. I think that because these are the first non-compliance decisions, that it's really important that the commission gets them right. It's really important that they are not perceived to be retaliatory tariffs. It's really important that they are perceived to be carrying out the law as it was designed to be carried out, that the fines are proportionate. And for that reason, I think these fines are pretty small compared to what you would need to use if you really wanted to incentivize compliance in a financial sense. And I believe that that choice makes sense when you're in the tariff environment and international relations environment that we're in, and also when you'd like a court to be assessing the implementation of the DMA for the first time and say, yes, this fine is fine. And because the law has the ability to ratchet up the fines over time with persistent non-compliance, what it means is that these platforms can get away with not complying for another year or two because they're going to take advantage of this introductory, let's teach the courts how to do it and everybody practice. But eventually, the tools are there for the fines to get much more substantial. So I think we shouldn't imagine that this is the first and last salvo in the enforcement game, but rather, as you said earlier, it's a long process, and it's going to be unfolding and hopefully escalating in a way that causes actual compliance, that produces results on the ground that are helpful for end users, and that would be alternative app stores, alternative digital wallets, more choice in hardware that connects to the digital platforms, more ability to control the use of your personal data in a way that you find helpful, not irritating, and other things like that. But I do want to reiterate that with noncompliance, the fine goes up, the possible fine goes up to a maximum of 20% of global turnover and includes these structural powers. So it's not a place that you want to get to, really, if you're one of these corporations. I would be very nervous about having had three noncompliance decisions and having the commission able to do all of these things, which a court is not going to stop them because such a corporation is demonstrating a disrespect for rule of law.
These are such interesting perspectives because I come at this historically from the tax perspective. And like Breton was saying, there's been all this drama between the US and the EU over digital services taxes. And listeners, if you're interested in that, I would encourage you to go back to our December 2023 podcast with Benjamin Angel from the Commission and Pascal Saint-Amans, formerly of the OECD, talking through the efforts to untangle how it attacks digital services, big platforms in this global economy, whereas Breton says it's hard to decide where the revenue is being earned and where the tax is being generated. It's a great podcast. Do go back and listen to it. Breton, I want to hear what you had to say. And I also would like to ask both of you to talk a little bit more about app stores. We focused on data. We focused on regulation. Apple's app stores have been the source of a lot of frustration from within the industry and with regulators for a long time. So I'm wondering how today's fine weighs in on that.
I would like to push this a little bit beyond compliance and fines, because after all, the objective of the DMA is to have a more contestable market, to create more competition between these digital service providers, and overall have an environment that is more beneficial for consumers. And so the question is, assume that the commission is going to ratchet up the pressure on these platforms, increase fines if necessary, and eventually they will comply and the DMA will be implemented. How is that going to affect EU consumers and producers? And for instance, the question of the app store. So let's assume that Google and Apple will open up. Well, Google has already partially opened up its app store, and that they both will have a completely open app store, and that anybody can upload alternative app stores in their phones, either on Android or an Apple iPhone, and there's competition. How will that landscape evolve? I see possibilities for increased competition, but I see this mainly for large players in app stores. I see the possibility for large game developers, for example, who have tens of millions or hundreds of millions of users. They will create their own app store. They will circumvent Apple and Android fees. They will have their own fee rates. Whether they will be much lower than what Apple or Android charges at the moment, I don't know. But they will have their own. But for your average company, it makes very little sense to open their own app store. There may be niche markets for particular app stores. I think probably the best example, and I always come back to this, is if we look at the Android landscape in China, of all places, because the Google Play Store was taken out of China by Google's own decision at one point in time because they didn't want to comply with the Chinese government censorship requirements. And all of a sudden, there was a very fragmented app store landscape with hundreds of app stores under the Android system. And we see now that this is coalescing and converging again around a dozen or two dozen big companies in China, and then hundreds of very small app stores that cover small niche markets. Is this better or worse for consumers? I think the jury is still out there. Yes, if you're an average consumer and you use a couple of dozen ads and you find them in the big app stores from one of the big companies, you're probably not much bothered by this. If you want to go and look for more niche market applications, you'll probably find them only in a few app stores. You have to scan all app stores to find them, or somebody has to guide you to these app stores. And so a whole new landscape has developed, where we see that for app developers, they have to be present in many app stores if they want to sell. So it's more costs for them. For consumers, sometimes more search costs to find the app that they are looking for, and not necessarily more security in all these very different app stores. So let's see how such a fragmented app store landscape compares with a more concentrated landscape. Well, I think we don't know the answer to these questions yet.
I wouldn't call it more concentrated. I would call it monopoly. I think that's an important distinction. Every app you might want is dumped into the same app store, which has got millions of apps, most of which you don't use. I have a different perspective than Burton. I would think about this the way you think about your video distribution. It used to be that there was a monopoly video provider for most countries. In the United States, I had, for example, Comcast providing me video. And now there are many different places to get video. And it's true, it's complicated. I have to search, I have to choose. They curate different ways, but boy, do I love it because the quality's gone up. I can buy a service that focuses on the kind of content that I want. They have to compete with each other on price and service. Comcast was terrible. So, I'm just a fan of competition. I think it tends to work out better than monopoly most of the time.
I mean, you talk about video and Comcast. Comcast supplies the data connection to get you that video, but it's different from the streamer of the video, which is Amazon.
It didn't used to be. That was the thing. Back in the day, they provided the video too, and there wasn't any such thing as streaming anything. You got stuff over the airwaves, or it came in that cable, and you signed up for the cable and the content were the same service. Initially.
That's true. If we go back that far, that's a couple generations earlier. And
No, I'm not that old.
Technology generations, which move every couple years, as we know. The iPhone is pretty new and we're already on what, 16 now? But if we look at music, which is another example where there's a very fragmented situation, none of the streaming music providers pay the artists as much as touring and selling physical media. So whether we have a single app store or whether we have a bunch of app stores, getting from distribution to money for creators is always going to be a headache. And I don't know that we've seen yet that we're actually going to get to this plethora of app stores, even if we think it's a good idea. It hasn't really happened yet. So that's why I'm so interested in whether this fine will maybe push some of these new entrants to get into the market.
Yeah, well, that's of course exactly the idea. And while we have the monopoly model and the China model, we don't have the model that I think is most likely to occur, which is names that people trust, that have the technological expertise and have enough scale to be giving you a bunch of things entering. So I would imagine that you'd have some names in finance, you'd have some names in entertainment, you'd have some names in, maybe there would be a news co-op, maybe there would be a children's store, maybe there'd be an environmental nonprofit that curated a bunch of apps that had low carbon footprints, and people who cared about that could use that as their main store and try to avoid other apps. Anyway, there are a bunch of different business models, and I have a Bruegel paper about that if anyone's interested. But I would say in terms of the fines and do we get there, remember one of the Apple noncompliance findings was that Apple was not letting a developer link out. So one way to stimulate interest in rival stores or to have Apple innovate within its own ecosystem, like maybe Apple could have a children's store or a green store, is when the app can just get out. So I can go look at the developer's app and the developer says, if you want to buy this for less or have a better deal or more capabilities, click here, go to my website, buy it there. Or let me tell you about the other app store I have that's a place you could go to get it for less. That kind of information lets users disintermediate the gatekeeper platform. And disintermediation is a very powerful incentive for everybody, both the entrants and Apple itself.
Rebecca, you mentioned music. This is one of my favorite hobby horses, I'm afraid. It's a very different landscape in music versus film streaming. In music, if you go to Spotify or Apple Music or Deezer, you basically get all the music you can possibly imagine. It's all together in one place. If you go for streaming, you have to go to many different platforms, and on each one you'll find, 1,000 films, maybe a bit more, but not the ones you're interested in, and you have to go and multi-home across many different streaming platforms.
So, Burton, I just have to stop you for one second, because in the United States anyway, there's something called a universal search feature on my Roku box, and I can put in the name of the content.
Yes.
And it tells me which service has it. So I search one time.
Yeah, that exists in Europe.
But it's expensive if you can't afford to subscribe to everything. It does add up.
Exactly.
No. I'm not saying, no, the universal search is not expensive. The universal search tells you where your show is located. Now, it's true. You have to decide whether you want to subscribe to that, but you're not trolling around the internet wondering what to do. You have the answer right in front of you.
Search is there, but switching costs are high. So you have to switch subscriptions or take all of them at once. And that's very expensive. By the way, I don't have an answer. I don't see anybody who has an answer to explain why this is different on film compared to music. But maybe you have it, Fiona.
I think I do. Well, at least in the United States, we regulate. The music licenses are regulated. And so if you want to have at least a service that's non-interactive, that just plays at you like a Pandora, you can get every single song at the regulated rate. And because that exists as a service, the thing that people expect then is streaming that's controllable by the user also with everything. And so the norm has grown up that there aren't exclusives on particular distribution channels, but that everything is everywhere. I think it's a product of the underlying regulation from 100 years ago.
Some of it goes back to the radio, but there are some abilities to have exclusions. We see that with Jay-Z and Tidal. We see that with Neil Young pulling his stuff from Spotify. From a user perspective, there is an access there that we don't have in video, possibly for the reasons you describe, and certainly radio licenses have a lot to do with that. But on the artist side, the artists don't get paid, and that is very much a work in progress. They get paid a very, very small amount, and the number of streams they have is so ginormous to make even a tiny bit of money. So it's a different regulatory challenge. But to bring it back to the app stores, it almost sounds like you need an app store for your app store. At this point, could we end up in a situation where you have to get a box like your iPhone that acts as your Roku box to tell you which app store you need to buy the thing? And could that in turn be abused?
I have a Bruegel publication that describes the issues around app stores. I think that requiring the operating system to enable universal search is really important, because otherwise you are wandering around, wondering where your content is. A second thing that I think would be quite functional would be a store of stores, so that you, instead of just having an app store with a lot of apps in it, there would be a pre-installed store from the operating system and the manufacturer that had the licensed stores available. And by the way, my vision of the way this would actually be good for consumers is not to let just anybody open up a store, but to have a process that involves making sure you're law-abiding and look after data and have insurance and so forth, so that there would be some security that was ensured by that regulation for consumers. And then also the apps, of course, that such stores distribute have to be approved by the operating system owner, because we have to know if they're going to work or not. So there's a separate process for approving apps that I think would just continue. And then the question of where those apps showed up and how much a user paid or the developer paid to get access to them would be the part of the chain that would be affected by competition between stores. And users could choose, do I want to have the green store and get rid of everything else and just run my life through that? Or do I want the green store and the finance store and the, I don't know, the store for people who like to travel or something like that?
But the operating system still has a big role to play. And when we're looking at gatekeeping, that seems like something that could be a recurring issue in this DMA environment.
I'm not sure it has a big role to play in the world I'm describing. It would have to set up the 10 steps about what to do about being law-abiding and so forth. And then that store would be installed in the store of stores. But after that, there wouldn't be anything the operating system needed to do to make it go. They would just approve apps in the normal way, and it would be up to the store to set its pricing policy and choose which apps it wanted. So I don't think it requires much from the OS.
The way that I look at it is, well, my search engine for apps is basically Google Search. And more people actually get to the apps that they are looking for by going through Google Search. The data show that. And so on the other hand, as Fiona just said, you need somebody who creates the apps, who says, this is a valid app, this is legitimate, this works well, this is secure, this handles your data in legally accepted way. And that's the role of app stores.
Wait, sorry, Burton, I'm confused. Curation normally means I choose blue and green instead of yellow and red. But you were talking about, does it actually function?
Not curation in the sense of a museum curator who says, these are original paintings painted by that painting. I certify that this is a real painting, that this is not a fake.
Okay. So I think that's not how we normally use the term in entertainment, that curation would be a taste thing as opposed to a functionality.
It's a functionality
thing.
For
so
me.
So approving the app,
yeah,
does it
yeah,
work?
Yeah, that's what I meant by it.
You mean functionality.
Yes, yes. And so that's the role of an app store, a gatekeeper, let's say, who says, I accept this app because it complies with a number of requirements and I reject other apps who don't. And so there can be many of those gatekeepers. But then the role of the operating system. But you can imagine you can have apps, and most apps today are written for two operating systems, iOS and Android. But imagine you would have many more of those operating systems. Then you developers would have to rewrite and adapt their app, and so there are increasing costs for developers. Also, the fact that you would have many app stores, if users still go through the app stores as the intermediary, they would have to advertise in these app stores, make sure they get somewhere on top of the ranking in function of the search term you've entered. By the way, search in app stores at the moment is horrible. It's very inefficient. And the reason why people go through the Google search engine, I think, is because Google search is much more efficient to find an app than doing it in the app store itself.
It's so interesting how all of this works, because in every case, we go down sort of a line of how this relates to other things. In video games, for example, there's a long history of porting these games over from one operating system to another, and they employ whole teams of people to get them from your computer to the Microsoft console to the Sony console. And so There's curation, like Fiona was saying, in terms of who's selling and doing the money, but there's also functionality in who's deciding whether it runs on the actual operating system. And that is the developer, but that's also the person who runs the operating system. If the operating system won't let you on, none of the artsy people, if to use this metaphor, can choose. I really appreciate you guys taking a minute to talk this through because I know there are listeners are going to have so many questions, and hopefully your listeners write us if you have things you want to talk about, because we could do so many episodes about this. We are sort of towards the end of our time, so we'll just come back to each of you and ask if we can talk again through the two fines. We got two fines so far. Apple, 500 million, Meta, 200 million. Fiona was saying that these can be recurring if they don't remedy in time, and that as they recur, they're subject to much larger penalties. We're also expecting other fines against other companies. And oh, by the way, there's a global trade war. If you have any final thoughts on specifically the role of fines, as opposed to the role of regulators or the role of tech regulation, but specifically how the fines will affect either investors in these companies or the economies that we're talking about. Here I am piling on again, or the big political picture. Anyway, now is our chance to try and leave listeners with a coherent thought so they can go thinking about all the ways this is going to affect our lives.
Look, it's a process and it's an important step. They've taken an important step. It's a step we all expected would be taken. So that's good. It's a significant amount of money that's going to move the process to the next stage where courts have to review. And then we have to actually see if it causes compliance, which is in the end the final goal.
I agree with that. So it's the start of a process, and this was long expected, and we'll see how far that goes. How far it goes in court, how much the commission may escalate fines to enforce compliance, or whether companies will eventually comply. And then, as I said before, even if they comply, what will be the impact of all that compliance?
This has been The Sound of Economics with Bertin Martens and Fiona Scott Morton. I always learn so much talking to you, and it always makes me want to go and read all your other papers, which are available on our website, Bruegel.org. You can find all of this stuff there. It's free, it's available. Go listen to the archives. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.